Good morning, everyone. I wanted to make two announcements before we begin. First, Judge Coffey is, in fact, with us. He is participating by speakerphone, so that's why you see the speakerphone on the table. So he will be fully participating in these oral arguments. And secondly, at 10 o'clock, the court is going to pause for a two-minute moment of silence for Michael Lefko and Donna Humphrey, whose murders occurred a year ago today. So we are going to observe a moment of silence for each one of them in commemoration of that event. So we will alert counsel when the time comes. So with that said, we are ready to hear the first case of this morning, Kusilek against Barnhart.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, Timothy Semph appearing for Kathleen Kusilek. This is a review of Judge Crabb's decision of the Western District, State of Wisconsin, on a denial of EJIA fees pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2412D. The issue is whether the Commission was substantially justified in its conclusion to deny benefits originally, and thus in turn to deny EJIA fees. In reviewing this, the court had to look at, of course, the facts and the law and make its application. The standard of review here is whether Judge Crabb abused her discretion in denying the EJIA fees. To give a little bit of background, this case went before Judge Crabb originally and was reversed on the basis that the hypothetical given to the vocational expert at the hearing did not include the requisite restrictions that were set forth by the medical and mental examinations.
Well, didn't Judge Crabb find that the law, both within this circuit and around the country, about the way these hypotheticals are supposed to capture some of the restrictions, whether it's phrased in job terms or whether it's phrased in medical terms, is not a settled question. Even though you prevailed, and nobody's questioning anything about that, the government was substantially justified in urging that what the administrative judge had done was appropriate.
I think the judge erred really in that's the big issue. There are two other things that were on appeal that I think the court needs to consider. One issue on appeal was the credibility of the claimant, and the judge and the magistrate, in their opinion, indicated that the ALJ exaggerated the issues in regard to the credibility of the claimant. Even though they didn't reverse on that issue, I think the court has to look at the overall case, and that's one thing I believe the court has to look at.
Well, I mean, but actually, from your point of view, I mean, I think we do look at the overall case, but looking at that, the commission comes off even better, doesn't it? They prevailed on two out of three the arguments.
Sorry, Your Honor. Just because they prevailed, likewise we prevailed, that doesn't mean we get our fees. They may prevailed on the credibility issue, but still, you have to look at the overall case, and there are some issues in regard to that. They also indicated that the other appeal issue was whether or not the claimant met the listings. And the Judge Crabb and the magistrate indicated that technically they made an error there. They didn't reverse on that either. But I think that goes into the overall case because there is many problems with the way this case was originally decided by
well,
the
but
ALJ.
Of course, the substantially justified standard really means that even if you lose, you may have been presenting a point of view that was fairly debatable on the law as it was, and the balance between when people are entitled to get fees and when they aren't that Congress has drawn is this substantially justified standard. So why isn't the place this court should be focusing exactly whether the law was really all that uncertain at the time?
Well, getting back, and maybe I'm not answering your question, but getting back to the hypothetical,
That seems to me to be, as you said, too, the key point of the case.
What the ALJ did not take into account is we had two psychologists here. We had Mary Fisher, who indicated that this claimant had problems with persistence, pace, and motivation. Dr. Hodges indicated couldn't maintain attention, concentration for extended periods of time, couldn't do simple work-related decisions, could not complete a normal work day, could not perform at consistent pace, could not accept instructions and respond appropriately to criticism from supervisors, issues in regard with getting along with coworkers, problems with responding appropriately to changes in work settings. And out of that, all those restrictions, what the ALJ comes up with is they can't do simple, they have to have low-stress routine jobs. Well, we have all these restrictions, and the judge boils that down to that. I think that's the overall major error here. But I think those other two issues on appeal also make this show the overall way that the court, the ALJ, looked at the underlying case. It seems to be replete with problems from the analysis standpoint.
In most of these cases, that at least the ones that we see, the government wins. Most cases that we have, Social Security appeals. In the cases where the government loses, do you have any idea what percentage of those cases the government's position is found to be not substantially justified?
I haven't done any statistics, but I've been doing this work for 15 years, and I think that, and of that, I think we weren't even aware of EJF fees until about 10 years ago, but I would say of the cases, this is probably the only one, to be honest with you, Your Honor, out of five.
It's a very small subset of cases that the claimant wins where the government's position is found to be not substantially justified.
I don't think I've ever had it raised. I've had the different appeals on whether this was a Section 4 decision or a Section Sentence 4, Sentence 6. Maybe I'm messing up my terms, but I don't think I've ever seen this raised, to be honest with you.
See, it just, to me, doesn't seem like this is such an egregious case, and if the government's position here is not substantially justified, then I wonder when it would be.
Well, then how do the claimants who's going to take these cases when they're not going to take them up on appeal?
Well, that's an argument for having having a complete fee-shifting rule. If the claimant wins, they get their fees, but that's not the law.
Well, I mean, with these restrictions, and when you get down to this, to the fifth analysis here, the burden is shift to the government to prove their case, and you have all these restrictions in here, and they're uncontroverted, there isn't a psychologist at the hearing, and the judge takes this and boils it down to say low stress and routine. I mean, I think they have a duty to lay out to the vocational expert a little bit more clarification.
That's the kind of that's the kind of case you would need. You would need some line of cases at a minimum in this circuit, perhaps around the country, saying administrative law judges do not have the power to boil down a long list of restrictions and summarize them as a particular job limitation. I mean, if there were lots and lots of cases that said that and the government was hammering away, still trying to get that point across, then I could see, okay, not substantially justified. But I have the same concern Judge Evans has, which is to make this something other than a pure fee shift, we need to look more carefully.
It's hypothetical, but what if the judge didn't take any of the restrictions?
Well, then that might not be substantially justified either.
Okay.
Right. You're in your rebuttal time if you
okay.
want to save
Thank you.
A bit. Ms. Cohn?
Your Honors, I'm Carol Cohn, representing the Commissioner of Social Security. As has been said, the EJA is not a fee-shifting statute, and this Court reviews the district court's EJA decision for abuse of discretion. the district court in its EJA decision laid out very carefully the factors it considered regarding substantial justification, and this is clearly not the time to relitigate the case or to look back to the two out of three issues on which the district court in the merits decision found in favor of the commissioner.
But here's my concern with the commissioner's position here. I think it must be fair to look at the original merits decision, which in this case is largely laid out in the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, and then consider, on what ground did the commissioner lose? Because if the original decision communicates the idea that this was a really close call, then surely the commissioner's position is substantially justified. If the original decision suggests that it really isn't, then why isn't that our best evidence for purposes of EJA fees?
I'm not saying don't look at the merits decision. I was saying that it appeared that my opponent was trying to look back at credibility in the listings. On the issue on which the merits decision was made, we would say that it was indeed a close decision. It was a close decision because the district court opinion made clear that while it did not find that the manner in which the hypothetical encompassed the particular mental limitations, it did encompass some of them, that the ALJ didn't disregard this, but he made a bona fide attempt to accommodate them. And as we have argued, his attempt to accommodate them is in a manner that is consistent with the law in terms of using vocational terms, which is commonly done. The Seventh Circuit has never said, for example, that the B criteria, which includes the moderate limitation on concentration, persistence, and pace, must be in a hypothetical question. And so the ALJ made an attempt to translate the mental limitations into terms to pose the question to the VE.
What I was going to say is that is in some tension with what I'm looking at is Appendix 140, page 27 of the report and recommendation, where the magistrate judge says the commissioner's argument is not compelling. He goes on to say, even if the ALJ had relied on Dr. Hode's functional capacity assessment, the commissioner cites no evidence to support her suggestion that the ALJ's limitation is hypothetical to jobs with an SVP of 3 or 4 is equivalent to a low-stress routine work limitation. So that's more particular. That's not saying you can't boil down. It's saying that the boiling down that happened here just has no evidence to underlie it. And that's, I think, the trouble. I'm looking at the blue brief, and at the bottom.
Could I?
Certainly. Thank you. I'm not sure how these numberings came to be, but at the bottom of the page, the very bottom.
I have the magistrate judge's appendix ending at 146. What is the...
Right, if you go back to 140,
oh, 140
is the page that I'm looking at, which is where the magistrate judge turns to the way this hypothetical question was phrased and explains why the commissioner's argument is not compelling.
But while he stated there that the argument was not compelling, he in fact said that insofar as the plaintiff was limited with regard to her concentration, not her persistence and pace, the limitation to simple work might suffice. With regard to the persistence and pace, which relates to Dr. Hodes's having said that she needed low-stress routine work, he went on to say that it was not clear that this might not even be harmless error.
Well, he does say that, but later on at Appendix 143, which is page 29, I'm not sure he goes as far as you're saying, because he says it's unclear how he translates, this is somebody else, Fisher's conclusion or his own finding that plaintiff suffered from moderate deficiencies of concentration, persistence, or pace into the SVP 3 or 4, basically summarizing.
I'm not saying that because that might be harmless error and she wouldn't get benefits that's all we're relying on. I'm saying that indicates that is one factor that the district court could consider with regard to the reasonableness of what the ALJ did and what we did in defending the case. With regard to Dr. Fisher's statement and then Dr. Hodes' statement, I think the district court in the EJA decision pointed out that it was a narrow issue, it wasn't raised by the complainant, and that the ALJ made an attempt to accommodate these things, and that was not plainly wrong. Okay, it's as I said, the use of the so-called medical terms as opposed to the vocational terms is not mandated, or the ALJ made it what we would say is a reasonable attempt in law and fact to accommodate those. The case was remanded because the court found that it was not adequate, but we would maintain that this represents substantial justification. And it's important in this case to look, as we have said, at the case as a whole. And frankly, at the district court level, the mental issue was a very small part of what was litigated. The magistrate judge's opinion, the district court's opinion, focused on that, perhaps rightly so. But in terms of the government making fact-finding decisions and applying the law to all of the problems this woman had, that really was a small part of the whole litigation until the EJA level, or until the district court decision was written. So looking at the case as a whole, we maintain that the government was substantially justified. And we ask the court to affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Senf, anything more?
Just briefly, Your Honor. I disagree with the fact that was a small issue in the case. I mean, it was she was sent to the psychologist for an examination, Dr. Mary Fisher and Dr. Hodes. So it was a substantial issue in the case. One thing that I'd like the court to pay close attention to is the decision at page 9, where the judge indicates that towards the bottom, I agree with the magistrate judge that low-stress routine work is not exactly the same as unskilled or simple semi-skilled work. Nonetheless, it was not unreasonable. And I guess I question whether a finding that this is unreasonable equals substantially justified.
Why wouldn't it?
Because I think something can be unreasonable, reasonable, and substantially justified seems to be different. Standards. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm speaking from the hinterland.
Pardon?
I'm speaking from the hinterland. What didn't Judge Kraft go on to find that the commissioner's position was substantially justified by decisions from this court and several other circuit courts upholding the ALJ's finding that the plaintiffs with mental limitations can perform simple or semi-skilled work? Doesn't that sort of cover that? Isn't that a pretty clear and substantial finding?
I think she did find that, but again, it comes back to, again, whether or not they're taking into account the number of moderate restrictions that were placed upon this claimant.
Is there any case law in our circuit that says that you must recount each and every one?
Not that I'm aware of, no, Your Honor. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.